2012. My wife says to me, "Hey, I'm 8.5 months pregnant. When do you plan to decorate the nursery?" It was about 11 o'clock at night. So I said, "Hey, babe, I'm going to run to a 24-hour Walmart and I'm going to find some curtain rods." On my way home, coming up to a stop sign, a car from the left street ran the stop sign, four-way stop, and they swerved just enough to clip the front tire. My left leg twisted backwards underneath the bike, hit the ground, popped about a socket, fractured my pelvis, and I skid. The car backed up. The rear passenger opened the door to get out and help me. And we locked eyes, but then the driver just peeled out and took off. And I was left there in the street that night. There was these two, I call them guardian angels, these two women wearing white satin bathrobes. I'm like, am I going to heaven right now? Is this real? All I can remember is a deep desire to want to see my wife and my daughter. So I refused to get in the ambulance. I forced myself into these women's car and I made them drive me home because everyone I called that night didn't answer. My wife sat there for literally 4 hours picking pavement and chunks out of what looked like burger from my toe all the way to my crotch. And my wife's voice came out of nowhere. She said, "If I were you and I went through what you went through tonight, I could totally justify giving up on all humanity. However, I just want to remind you that whoever those kids were that left you there, whether they even went and got blind drunk tonight to forget about it, their whole life this will haunt them." It was right then that I recognized inside myself that redemption is only ours.
Jeremy Wilson, welcome to the Roller Coaster Podcast, my man. I'm excited to have you.
Excited to be here, brother.
This is, it feels like it's a long time in the making, but man, we only met like 2 months ago, but it feels like a lot longer. There's been a few men in my life like that recently with Adam and Justin and you that it's just a weird feeling, you know? So I'm excited to just unpack this with you. Like, how did this happen? Here's what I want to start with. You've got, in my opinion, some of the more different, out there, wild beliefs as part of your belief system than I've ever met. And it's really intriguing to me. What are some of those beliefs that are maybe not sort of common beliefs among society?
Man, I can think of two right out the gates. I'm the kind of guy that believes the universe doesn't make mistakes. I don't believe there's anything under the sun that God built that is junk. And so if you approach life with that belief, then you start to see the divinity in everything, the good, the bad, the ugly, and you can embrace more gratitude than people that are judging the circumstances of their life, the situations in the world, and you can embody that gratitude as a foundation that then serves a vision of seeing things even getting better and improving. And so, although I've gone through a lot of challenges, a lot of pain, a lot of resistance, a lot of difficulty in my life, having that belief has allowed me to accept those challenges as strengthening agents for my soul. And I have a belief that anything we go through that's uncomfortable is designed to give us strength of spirit, spiritual muscle. And so that's probably one of the biggest beliefs. A belief that's probably even more out there. You know, I love to ask people the question, what is the opposite of right?
What's wrong?
Most people would say wrong.
Yeah.
But here all this time, the opposite of right is left. And really, if you embrace that belief that it's not right or wrong, there's just right and left, you get to choose wholeness. And you get to choose what you want and what's impacting you and what's serving you instead of having a judgment of right or wrong. Now, I still believe in morality and ethics, and I believe all human beings are embedded. So it makes us different than animals. We're embedded with these beautiful design, divine guidance systems that allow us to know, quote unquote, which direction will bring more light in the world, which direction will obviously cause harm to ourselves and others, but I don't believe necessarily in right versus wrong.
Mm.
So those are a couple of the, probably the biggest ones.
The audience now has a look into what this episode's going to be like. help me reconcile how you've gotten to this place in your life. Like, the way that you talk is not the way that most men talk. You use words that men are scared of, which is light. And, you know, every time I talk to you, tell me to shine on. That's a light reference. You talk about energy. You talk about magnetism. You talk about spirituality. Like, what is that? Where does that come from?
You know, man, we could be here for 6 hours answering that one, but it does start when I was very young. I had a near-death experience. I drowned when I was 4 years old, like completely flatlined, had to be revived, you know, almost a half an hour later. So a complete, I would say not near death, a death experience. And I still remember being in the hospital and not knowing entirely what was even happening. I couldn't walk. I couldn't move, but I was conscious. And I remember, you know, people coming to visit. And I remember the doctors and the nurses with pity and sympathy. Oh, that poor boy. And just the sadness on their face. It was probably like, you know, I was in the hospital 11, I think 12 days total. And I remember, like, I felt those feelings the first 3 or 4 days. Like, maybe I'm supposed to feel this way. Poor me. And I remember sitting in the room. It was probably day 4, day 5. I mean, I had to relearn how to walk. I had to, you know, as a child, I had to go through childhood twice. And I remember laying in the bed and looking out the window and seeing the breeze blow the leaves in the trees, and the sunshine was coming through the window. And all I could think, I'm alive. There's light. Everything on earth is here. We're alive together. Everything that is. And I think that's where it started. It started with just recognizing that we are alive. And even in the face of adversity, it was early on that I started to look at the rest of the world like, you guys, the clouds are out. Look at the beautiful sky. The sun is shining. And even when it was raining, it's all a part of life. And so I think that having that experience and a handful of other near-death experiences in my life journey has helped shape a deeper sense of understanding about life, right? Like, ultimately, when your body goes, your body's still here, right? Like, you can flatline, but what does your body lose? It loses the electrical imprint. And so as long as we have a pulse, we're alive. There's light. There's animating spirit. And there has to be a greater cause that provides that, right? So let me say this. I think even as I grew a little older, I was always obsessed with just wanting to learn, wanting to know more about the earth. I just always had a curious conviction to want the truth. And I used to just read encyclopedias at my grandma's house. And I used to study the history of the earth and geology and the cosmos from a very young age. And if you just look at the history of our existence, not as a species, but as a planet, right? The sun has been shining this beautiful radioactive magical miracle in the sky for 4.6 billion years. And because of that life force-giving agent, we were able to have planets and the solar system. And for 4.5 billion years, we've had this ball of rock spinning around that big bright light in the sky. And you start to look at the variables of that possibility existing in the mass of outer space and infinite void, eternal in every direction. I mean, it's almost impossible not to recognize that all of life is a result of light, and that the amount of variables that have to occur for you to be born, right? Just the conversation of the sperm and the egg meeting is a 1 in 400 trillion chance. But then you add all the infinite variabilities, right? If Jupiter was a little further out in orbit, we would have been sucked into the sun a long time ago. And so I think that that's really what it's about. It's like, if you stop and you pause and you recognize that there's night and day, just the basics, that life is about light. And I'm not here to worship the sun. I believe there's a greater creator of everything. But I think it all goes back to my existentialism tied to my own life, witnessing a lot of other people come and go from this earth, losing loved ones from this plane, and being right on the edge of that myself. Just makes you recognize the light in people's eyes, in their spirit. And the last thing I'll say is, like, you know, if you're listening to this live here, or you're listening to the recording on this podcast, like, right now, is there anything else other than right now? That's it. The only thing that exists is this ever eternal moment. And I think that's so magical, because if you just take the population of the earth, I don't know how many it is, we're almost to 9 billion. Just pause right now for a second. Every single heart that's beating, and every single human on planet Earth, it's beating one heartbeat at a time right now, all of us. And so there's this unified field, but then there's the individual field affecting that. And so it's just really cool to stop and think, we're all alive. We're all here. We're all animating this electrical light.
Man, cool. Love that. You referenced the cosmos, right? You referenced your desire to understand the universe from a young age. And I think you continue to try to understand it, right? As do, you know, many, a lot of people do, right? Even though there's some odd 9 billion people on the earth, 8 to 9, somewhere in that range, plus or minus a billion, right? We're still so insignificant in the grand scheme of things, right? I saw this diagram the other day, which showed the size of the sun, right? Which I believe is the largest star in our solar system that we know of. And the sun is 1.3 million kilometers around in diameter. Okay. And then it showed the next largest star and the next largest star and the next that are outside of our solar system, right? And it showed the and I had to look this up while you were talking, the UY Scuti star, forgive my pronunciation, is 1.18 billion kilometers in diameter. So if you look at the sun next to this star, it's a speck on, I mean, it literally, you can't even see it to the naked eye. It's that small. But to us, the sun is this massive thing. And sometimes we think we're so big and so mighty as individuals. But the reality is we're so insignificant in the grand cosmos, right? So what are your thoughts on that?
I love this conversation, because I think that when you really take the time, whether you come from a scientific perspective or a spiritual perspective, and you just stop and you really consider the size and scope of the universe, the scale in which this expanded, whatever this thing is, right? You have to be humbled, and you have to recognize that we are not in control, and that there's very little that our existence has any effect over in the grand scheme of things. And you see that there is an eternal, infinite outside of yourself, and then you come back down here to Earth for a moment, and you go, what do we really know? Like, if you consider infinite perspectives, right? Yeah. It doesn't matter what religion you believe in. They all say the same stuff. We were created by an infinite creator that is free of time and space, and with God, all things are possible. So if you go, okay, with God, all things are possible, that means there's infinite perspectives, right? So if you consider infinite perspectives, what do you really know? I mean, only 5 to 7% of the world speak English. How much knowledge and awareness and perspective do you think that any one of us will ever achieve compared to all of humanity's knowledge and awareness? It's insignificant, right? It's not even measurable. It's so insignificant. And then you go out from there and you go, all right, what percentage of knowledge do you think all of humanity has achieved awareness and perspective of compared to the infinite perspective of God, our creator? Once again, it just amplifies to an infinite level of insignificance. And so therefore it's like, Even when we talk about truth, we talk about what is certain, maybe. Everything's just a probability, right? I love AI. AI doesn't believe in objective truth. AI only believes in low probability and high probability. And our sample is so small, here as humans of what knowledge we have access to, that I believe if you just do that, you stop and you go spiritually, wow, this place is kind of big. Or scientifically, doesn't matter if you look under a microscope, they keep inventing a new microscope that can see at atomic levels. And all we find is a whole nother world at every level of amplification, whether it's in a telescope or a microscope. We are insignificant compared to the grand scheme of the makeup of this hologram, this game, this life, whatever you want to call it.
So let me ask you this one. What is this all for?
So I love that question. So, I mean, we were given the five senses, sight, sound, touch, taste, and smell. And I'll tell you this, when the sun is shining and all the bright colors, the seven colors are out, you know, green, red, all the colors, when you can smell the beautiful fragrances of earth, whether you're in the forest or in the desert or on the beach, and you really allow yourself to embrace those senses, it's impossible to ignore that there is a thrill found in just being present to our senses. So I believe that the way we were wired with left brain and right brain and all of our core memories are formed and stored first and foremost on those senses, that we're here for the thrill of it all, first and foremost. This is our fucking playground, nice. Right? We're children of God.
Yeah.
You like to see your kids have fun and play. So I believe we're here to play and not play games. We're here to play for the sake of playing and enjoying the thrill of life. I think that's half of it. But in doing that, I've always been the kind of person that, because I'm good at playing, I'm good at bringing joy and love to every experience, even the ugliest, that oftentimes it's easy to see the contrast that not everybody has that ability. Yeah. And I don't like to eat steak when everyone else is eating beans, right? That's not very much fun. So I think the other side of it is showing people a path, giving people guidance, and providing those that are willing to evolve, to accept and receive their birthright of this playground, the kingdom of heaven we live in. That's the second side of it, is for us to learn and grow and contribute. You know, Tony Robbins, he has the six human needs. Maslow's hierarchy has the entire pyramid of needs. And I love the bottom two needs that Tony Robbins talks a lot about, growth and contribution. So when we experience pain that takes us away from our natural joy, you know, our child heart, whatever you want to call that, we have the ability to, I'm curious, what can I do to create more joy for myself or others? We're always divinely inspired and see the path, can provide the contribution to make this place better for not just us, but everybody. I think that's the purpose for it. It's to learn, to grow, and provide other people the opportunity to experience that love. And last thing I'll say about love related to that, I don't think it's something we're meant to force on anybody. I think everyone has to find that path on their own. But I love to use the word love as an acronym. Let others voluntarily evolve. I believe we're here for evolution. Now, I don't believe that Darwinism is the answer, but it's clear that there's evolutionary biology. And if you study evolutionary biology, you see that we conform to our conditions in a way that allows us to thrive, no matter what conditions you put any organism, any species, and including humans especially in. And so we are designed to thrive.
Well said. You've referenced the soul a couple of times. I would love for you to, hold on. Draw my pen. I would love for you to talk about, first of all, what is the soul? I think there's some ambiguity around this term. And then secondly, I know one of the things that you deeply believe in is the idea of soul science. And so I'd love for you to just unpack those things.
Absolutely. So soul, to me, there's a lot of different definitions. There's a lot of different perspectives. And I don't know that mine is right, but it seems the closest that I've found. And to me, the soul is our light body, right? Beyond the physical, I mean, even just study the sun. The sun is transmitting how many different vibrations and frequencies and variants of light, right? And most of it is harmful to humans. Then you have this beautiful earth, also a North Pole, South Pole, this magnetic You can't see our atmosphere, right? But it's there, and it's protecting us like a force field from all those harmful radiance of light coming from the sun. The only thing that breaks through our atmosphere, full spectrum light, is 40% of it. That's the light we see. 40% of the light that comes from the sun is the visible spectrum.
Yeah.
53% is infrared. Can't see it, but without it, cells can't duplicate on Earth. And then UV, our beautiful bathing light. Without UV, we'd just be a cesspool on Earth, and we spin under that nice little UV sanitation once a day, keeps things clean. And so you have to look at the human in the same way. It doesn't matter if you believe in spirit. It doesn't matter if you believe in soul. Science has proven we're all transmitting electrical energy, right? And that energy field, that toroidal vortex of voltage that each one of us is exchanging with each other in our outer environment and the cosmos, the sun and the Earth, when that light, when that energy, when that electricity leaves the body, your body's still here, but your soul is gone. And so a lot of focus goes into the physical because we're very left-brain creatures. What allowed us to become the apex predator in our evolutionary biology is our left brain, right? We watch for sharp edges. We sharpen spears around the campfire so we can take care of the tigers and the bears in the forest. And so we rose the ranks of all other species on this planet because we're wired to see problems. And so most of science has been built around left brain, tangibles, physicals, but even when we go back and talk about the light of the sun, 60% of it is light you can't see with the human eyes. But if you put on a different set of lenses, you can see night vision through infrared light or photography. Mm. You can Google Kirlian, K-I-R-L-I-A-N, Kirlian photography. You can see a picture of a leaf, an apple, or a hand. And you'll see that light is leaving your body just like the surface of the sun. And so to me, the soul is that electrical, the light body. And soul science is the study of how we exchange that energy with each other, how that energy processes through ourselves, through our nervous system, through our cognition, our brain, our thought processes, how we process emotions. I think it's a really powerful thing because soul science is really the study of the unseen influence, unseen energy, and how that affects our human behavior.
Every time I talk to you on the phone or in person, I give you a hug and I say bye for now. And you respond with bye, shine on. Tell me about this. We're talking about light here, light bodies. What is this shine on thing every time you say goodbye to somebody that you love?
Yeah, like 20 years. I think it would be kind of a unanimous confusion for anyone that really knows me if I left the room or left a conversation without saying it at some point, right? And it's usually shine the fuck on. it's really this clear, you know, like I mentioned, right now, if you're breathing and you have life in your body, then you're transmitting an electrical field. Hold your breath. Just hold it real quick. That energy field shrinks. When our body's starved of oxygen, it sends signals to the brain, fear, and all these things. Our energy field shrinks, pulls in. When you take a deep, deep breath, that light field expands. Yeah. And most people don't recognize that your emotional state governs and dictates your breathing patterns. So if you're angry, you're just breathing really shallow in the top of your lungs, just this little tiny light field, right? And when you're sad, when you're feeling shame, it's in the very bottom of your lung. Same thing. Just breathing into the bottom of your lungs. And so if you understand that, if you have a pulse, you have the ability with agency and choice, your free will, to recognize that your emotions don't have to govern your breathing patterns. Your breathing patterns can dictate your emotional state. It's proven on, you could go sit on biofeedback, you get a little cheap heart math inner balance meter and do it at home for a couple $100 and recognize that when you're in that coherent state, your energy field is just electric and we have the ability, good, bad, or ugly, no matter what you're going through, to recognize that that influences everything in our environment. And rather than be like a little flicker flame, just kind of like, that energy is the puppet outcome you can actually be the soul in control, and you can shine that light bright and as far and wide as you'd like.
The soul in control.
Soul in control.
That's a good one.
That's one of my favorites.
I appreciate that one. In an interview, you quoted Marcus Aurelius, and I've actually heard you quote many of the Stoics before, just in conversation that we've had. One of the quotes that you said, and I would love for you to unpack this after I read it, is, "It's time you realize that you have something in you more powerful and miraculous than the thing that affect you, than the things that affect you and make you dance like a puppet."
I love it. It's my favorite quote by Marcus Aurelius. Originally, I wanted to be a politician at some point in my life, and I wanted to know who our founding fathers quoted. And they all quoted Seneca and Marcus Aurelius and the Stoics. And I became obsessed when I was like 16, 17 years old, very gratefully. And this quote stuck with me deeply because, one, those first two words, first three words, I guess, it is time. Anytime you say it, it is time. There is no other time. And, you know, there's so many things in our outer environment, especially in the modern world. We have social media, you know, propagated news. There's a lot of things in our outer environment that can cause our attention to be focused away from the infinite, eternal, the amazing life, and gratitude for it. But there's also a lot of mechanisms inside of us, our internal mechanisms, our internal navigation system. And most people's thoughts are a distraction, and they chase those thoughts like a dog chases its tail. And then emotions, right? Every one of us, even the most zen versions of ourselves in traffic, have been pissed off about something. And so whether it's the external that affects the internal or the internal that then causes us to see the outside world in a different view, we are not our thoughts. And we are not our emotions. And I truly believe those mechanisms were designed for us to recognize that which we do have agency and free will over. Yeah. And we don't have to be the puppet of every thought. We don't have to entertain every thought, external or internal. And so that's really what it's about to me. It's like, I am not my thoughts. I am not my emotions. I am the soul in control. Mm. I was gifted that agency and will. And there's gratitude found in that, right? Doesn't it just light you up that you have control over your own internal state? That excites me.
Yeah, you mentioned gratitude a couple of times. And we planned a men's retreat for Levels that we've, you know, now we've talked about it on the podcast a couple of times. So the audience is familiar with that. But you know, you were one of the ones that really helped us think through some of the frameworks to teach the men that were at a retreat. And, you know, one of them I led the first night, which was a identity framework called Your Inner Critic, which I thought was great. I would love for you to share one or two frameworks live on the podcast today that would be helpful for men generally who may be struggling in life. So whether it's around gratitude, whether it's around the inner critic and sort of I am statement or any other ones, because I know you've taught like literally hundreds of these things. So like, I'd love for you to just choose maybe one or two that you could take the audience through today.
Yeah, I'll buzz through a couple. I'll start with this one. Identity and self-identification. You know, anybody that's ever struggled internally that starts to seek external advice to solve it, at some point ends up with counseling or therapy. They end up, you know, owning and identifying some, what I would call, associations that don't serve them related to their identity, which affect their self-worth, which affect their self-image. And so I think the first framework, part of me, it's a framework. If you can just say part of me, how many times when you're frustrated, you go, I'm fucking pissed off. I am angry. Hi, nice to meet you. Like it's a name on your shirt. We identify with our emotions, then we're the puppet. Now we've become them. We've given them the steering wheel. Yeah. You're no longer your personality. Now you are the expression of that emotion. Versus part of me, my body is feeling. I'm not angry. My body is feeling anger. Part of me feels frustrated. So I think that's framework number one. You have to dissociate and disidentify. You are not your emotions. And you have to separate. That's framework number one. Mm. right? Which I think is so powerful. Stop.
Good or bad, by the way.
Good or bad.
Even I am happy. Nope.
Like, part of me feels great right now.
Part of me is feeling happy. Part of me, yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, so compartmentalizing rather than, you know, claiming the totality of your existence tied to those, you know, fleeting thoughts and emotions.
Well said.
Right? That would be step one. Step two, another layer of disidentification. I can't remember where I learned this, but it's so much fun, especially with kids. But grown men can struggle in the modern world with self-beat up, right? Most high-performing individuals I've worked with, doesn't matter if they're pro athletes, celebrities, you know, high-powered multi-billion dollar CEOs of multinational companies, we all struggle with some form of self-beat up. We all know we can do better, right? If you're measuring against the eternal and the divine, we can all do better. And so it's easy to get lost in our stories and back to those I am statements, right? Or maybe you're going to do something new you've never done before, out of your comfort zone. I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I'm cut out for this. Maybe I'm not good enough. Those stories, whatever those stories are, four steps, here's a framework. Identify the story. I don't know if I can go on Tyler's podcast, right? What will people think? Whatever it may be for you. Some people can't speak on stage.
Yeah.
Some people, they don't want to share their vulnerable stories. Most men, they can't share their emotions with other men. I don't want to show anyone my emotions. They'll see me as weak. Right? So step one is identify the story. Step two is disidentify the story. So identify it, write it down in clarity. But step two is, say it in four voices that are not your own. Literally, that are not your own. Make it kind of funny, right? So I just kind of practiced a little. Give me a story. What's a story that sometimes you still struggle with?
Yeah, like you want me to do it in my voice?
Just what's the story first?
Okay, like I'm 33 years old and because I'm this age, I can't be as shredded as I was when I was 21.
Okay.
Impossible.
So at my age, I could never be as shredded as I possibly could be.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's the story. So now you're gonna say that story in four voices that are not your own. I want you to do, let's hear Mickey Mouse, maybe Kermit the Frog, and you pick the other two.
80s dying. I don't know if I can, I mean, I'm not a great impersonator, but.
It'll be fun.
Ho ho! At 33, I don't even know what the story is, dude. Know what I'm saying? Oh, at 33, I can't get shredded. Okay, that's Mickey Mouse. How was that? Okay, number two. Who was the other one? Kermit the Frog.
Let's do Kermit.
What does Kermit sound like? Give me just a little taste.
Very nasally. That's all I know.
Very neat. Okay.
Oh, at 33, I can't be shredded.
Okay.
Now let's go in ethnicity, just for fun.
Oh, Indian? Okay.
There you go.
At 33, I can't be shredded. Impossible.
Now do a whiny little bitch. Like,
at 33, I can't be shredded. That is ridiculous. I hated that. Like, I'm uncomfortable right now. This is part of the exercise, yeah. I'm assuming.
Yeah. So that was step two. Step okay. one is identify that story, okay. box it in, get really clear on what it is. Okay. Step two, say that story in four voices that are not your own. Okay. Step three is call bullshit. Everything I just said is absolute bullshit.
Yeah, everything I said is absolute bullshit.
And then step four is the because, opposing action and belief.
Yeah.
And vision for the opposite. Everything I just said is complete bullshit because I am getting in the best shape of my life. I'm finding my highest level of fitness and I am moving into my most evolved, jacked, ripped state. Nothing can stop me.
Mm.
Feel that?
Yeah.
I want to hear you say it.
All right. Everything I just said is bullshit because I know I can lock in the diet. I know I can do it. I've done it for stretches of time. I know what's required. I have great coaches that are supporting me and holding me accountable to my fitness journey and my fitness goals. And my kids and my wife deserve it. And it's for them, really, that I'm doing this and I can fucking do it. I believe that.
Powerful. So the biggest key is show and tell. So you can say those things, but immediately take opposing action. What action would you take if you didn't believe those things? That's step four.
Yeah.
Step four is take immediate opposing action. Part of me wanted to get up and start doing push-ups while you're saying that.
Mm.
Because if we believe in God and we believe our, whatever your belief is,
yeah,
is eternal and infinite, and with God all things are possible, I believe I'm a child of God, and God made me in the image of Him. And if I'm made in the image of infinite creation, all things are possible. It's the greatest belief. I don't think there's a greater belief than the belief that you were embedded on this planet by a great I Am of infinite proportions. And so step one, two, three, and four, if you always end four with that high perspective,
yeah,
no story has any power. And you practice that enough and you go and take opposing action enough, you can remyelinate those pathways that memorize those stories from your ancestors, your upbringing, and your conditioning that manifested those beliefs into a little box. And so I would give that framework. I want to give one more, though.
I just want to say one thing on that.
Please.
Dude, words are incredibly powerful. There's an object lesson that you're probably familiar with, right? Which is the power of words are so powerful that they do this object lesson where they take two plants, same exact plant. One of them, every single day, they say, this is the bad plant. Every single day, they say, we want you to talk negatively to this plant. Tell it it's not going to grow. Tell it it's ugly. Tell it it's whatever. Small, it's not going to get sunlight, nutrition it needs. The other one, they say, talk positively. So you are going to grow. You look beautiful. You're going to do this. The one plant that they give positive reinforcement to grows. The other plant dies. And it's a very real thing. I had to do that object lesson in college. Our entire, one of our class in college, we did it. And it's like, what? Right? So words are incredibly powerful. I appreciate that framework.
Absolutely. I love that study. I'm a huge fan of Emoto. I don't know if you've studied all of the water tied to that, the intention of that. There is no power on planet Earth that is greater than human intent. And it's not just some cute thing. Like Bruce Lipton, he wrote a book called Biology of Belief. He was an atheist when he started writing that book. They would take stem cells, and they could turn that cell into any type of cell in the human body with human intent. And they discovered, you know, validation of our morphogenetic field.
Yeah.
Our intention has the ability to affect and influence the plants, the people around us, our environments. And it's not just some woo-woo hippie talk. Yeah. Like, it is science.
Yeah.
And when you get really clear on intent and you're broadcasting that with your mouth or your inner voice, you may not see the light you're broadcasting, but it is very physical.
Yeah.
And it is affecting everything in your environment. So I want to give you this one piece tied to that. So there's a third. This blew my mind with these studies. They do it with rice. They do it with plants.
Yeah.
You're ugly. You're horrible. I hate you. Yeah. You're beautiful. I love you. You're amazing. They ignored the third. The one they ignored was the one that had the most detriment.
Yeah, it was the worst. Yeah. I remember this.
So the one even that had attention.
Yeah.
Think about this with kids. If they're not getting the positive, loving, convicted affirmation, bad attention is better than
no attention. Wow.
And so there's so much power in that. And we were given the ability with eyes to see and ears to hear and focus to direct, to pay attention to anything we want. And we have influence with our human intent to shift and bring light, beauty, just through our objective attention. I love that one.
I love that. Did you want to do one more object lesson?
Yeah, you know what?
Framework?
I won't spoil it because, you know, I know now that's an important part of the signature experience for levels, so I don't want to spoil the whole experience, and I also share that experience at some of my signature events. But, yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter what your income levels are, how sexy you are when you look in the mirror, how many friends and family love you. They've proven that all humans, right? We have 50 to 90,000 thoughts on average. Entrepreneurs have 300 or 400 thoughts a day. And it doesn't matter who you are. 87% of our thoughts, on average, are negative self-talk related to our identity. Most people are living in dramatic paranoia, and it's been amplified because of social media, right? We're comparing ourselves to other people all the time. And so you're not good enough. You're ugly. You're fat. You're lazy. All of these stories of the inner critic are there. And when you make a decision to eat the cheeseburger instead of the grilled chicken, you're making a decision that amplifies that inner critic, yeah. Right? And so all I will say, identify those stories. Just like that first exercise, identify every single one of those stories. And I won't spoil the exercise sure. We're talking about, but you've got to run those stories through that process. You have to take action on the opposite, because as long as you don't, your inaction is the greatest affirmation of those stories. Yeah. But your action in opposition will immediately breed confidence for the mind, emotional certainty for the heart, and completely shift and shape your self-image, your self-worth, and the love you feel when you look in the mirror in your own eyes. And so, especially the men that are listening, but women too, you know, comparanoia, you know, they say comparison is the thief of joy. Well, it is. And you might not be as good at something else as your neighbor, but we all have unique talents and skills and abilities. And it's very important that you get really clear on what those are, because you may have all Fs except one A. And if you focus on what you're failing at, you're not going to like yourself. But if you focus on what you're amazing at and you pour your energy and attention into that, you will only find divine beauty and joy all around you and in your own self-worth.
It's really well said.
Thank you to our sponsors over at Bucked Up. I love this company. I love their products, their apparel, and their supplements. Recently, they dropped the mother of all pre-workouts, Mother Bucker. This is not for the faint of heart. This will make you want to claw your face off. So don't get stuck in traffic when you're headed to the gym. I love these guys. I love this company, and I love their products. They are clearly the best tasting pre-workout on the entire market, and they're number one for a reason. Bucked Up is my favorite workout brand, hands down. And they also have my favorite apparel for working out and just for daily life. It's Lululemon-like quality, but for a fraction of the price that's affordable. So head over to their site, buckedup.com, where you can check it out. And for 20% off their entire site, use the code TylerHall20.
You referenced an experience earlier where you almost died, or you basically did die and was brought back to life when you were 4 years old in a drowning accident. It's not the only time in your life that you've almost died, though. Correct. You had an experience in 2012 that, I mean, it's... I think the audience is going to be holding onto the edge of their seat as you tell the story. So what happened to you in 2012?
So 2012, my wife and I at that time had an 18-month-old little girl, our daughter Gianna, who's now 13. And my wife was 8.5 months pregnant in July of 2012 with our son, who's now 11. And it was just a little over a week before he was born, 8 days before he was born. Any parents listening that have multiple kids can probably get this. First baby, the day we found out it was a girl with the ultrasound, we left that appointment. I was at the mall. I threw down a couple G's on girl clothes. Everything was ordered off Amazon to decorate the nursery. And I'm pretty sure it was like 3 days later, rush shipping. It was done. I didn't stop. She had a fully stocked room. It was like she already lived there months in advance. Our son, we had all the stuff ordered, but it was just sitting in boxes in his little bedroom. 8.5 months in. We're taking poor care guy. Of an 18-month-old, right? Totally.
Yeah.
And my wife says to me, it was a weekend. It was a Sunday. Sunday morning. She's like, hey, I'm 8.5 months pregnant. When do you plan to decorate the nursery? Put all the furniture together. And so I spent the whole day on Sunday decorating the nursery, getting everything ready. And I'm a guy that really loves completion. I do. Not perfection, but I like completion. And so it was about 11 o'clock at night almost. And the only thing I didn't have was curtain rods to put the curtains on the wall. So I said, hey, babe, I want to finish this tonight. So it's just done and you're ready and you can nest up. I'm going to run to 24-hour Walmart and I'm going to find some curtain rods and I'm going to hang the curtain rods on the wall. And I was like, you know what? I'm also going to get some gas in my bike, my motorcycle, because I like to take it to work in the mornings. So I never drove my bike at night, and you can probably already tell where the story's going. I went to old Wally World, as we called it in Montana, Walmart. And on my way home, I still remember I was playing. Actually, I had been hit on my motorcycle by a car a couple previous times, different motorcycles, sold them. And I was inspired by one of my favorite movies, Tron, Legacy. There's a scene at the very beginning of the movie where the kid grows up and he's on his motorcycle. And I'm a huge Daft Punk fan. And that was the soundtrack of the movie. And I was watching, and it inspired me to get a motorcycle again, right? And I got this badass Harley Davidson XR1200X, basically when the economy crashed and they consolidated the entire Buell brand, which is Harley's sports bike brand. Yeah. They poured all that technology into this one motorcycle under the Harley label. And very heavy bike, not a normal super bike, 450-pound wet bike. So long story short, I was driving home and I was playing the song that is playing during the movie that where I was inspired to get the motorcycle. And I'm coming up to a stop sign. I was going about 35 miles an hour, and before I even had time to pump the brakes and slow down to the stop sign, you know, you're just first applying the brakes. A car from the left street ran the stop sign, four-way stop, almost on two wheels, coming head on right toward me. So I slammed the brakes, and the back end of the bike came all the way up, and they swerved just enough to clip the front tire. And the way that the bike hit the ground, my left leg twisted backwards underneath the bike, and it hit the ground and popped my, you know, hip out of socket, fractured my pelvis, and I skid for quite a ways, over 100 feet, with my left leg under the motorcycle. Now, my stupid ass had a helmet on, had a leather jacket on, but I was wearing Keen sandals and shorts. Yeah, so as you can manage, it was pretty grotesque. And lo and behold, the car backed up. I still remember it. So like Volkswagen Jetta. And the rear passenger opened the door to get out and help me. I was screaming. It was some of the most intense pain ever, having your bones drug across the pavement. And we locked eyes, but then the driver just peeled out and took off. And I was left there in the street that night. And first I was just filled with my warrior rage. I just wanted to chase him, hurt him, you know. But there was these two, I call them guardian angels, these two women. There was witnesses, and a man jumped out of his truck to try and help me get up and get the bike out from under me. And these two women, it's not relevant for any purpose, but these two lesbian women wearing white satin bathrobes, okay, matching white satin bathrobes are like standing there. I'm like, am I going to heaven right now? Is this real? And all I can remember is a deep desire to want to see my wife and my daughter. And I didn't know. I just knew there was a lot of blood and I couldn't stand on my own. I was refusing medical care. I couldn't even hear anyone talking. All I could think about was getting home to my wife and my kids in case this is it. And so I refused to get in the ambulance. I refused to speak with police. And fortunate, back then I used to carry a bunch of cash. And I forced myself into these women's car. And I made them drive me home because everyone I called that night didn't answer. I tried to call my wife, all my friends. 19 phone calls went to voicemail. And so I went home and I hopped on one foot up the, you know, the front sidewalk to my house, and I banged on the door and rang the doorbell. And my wife, who was already sleeping at that time, because it was probably like close to midnight, maybe even a little later, she opens the door and there's her one-legged husband with a trail of blood up the sidewalk standing with a mangled leg. And that night, there was a moment, though, when I was laying on the street before the rest of the chaos. You know, they left me there before I could even fathom what fully happened. It was right when I turned the music off under my helmet and got my helmet off, and not knowing if that was going to be my last moment. There was a lot of blood. I was losing a lot of blood. I just remember this, man, even as I talk about it now, it just fills me with warmth and love. It was then I had practiced enough of these affirmations and had enough recognition from MMA fighting and, you know, skydiving and crazy experiences where the chaos is high, being able to find my center. It was like autopilot. There's a part of me that literally spoke, I call it the voice, whatever you want to call it. It was outside of my control. And it was, you're not these thoughts. You're not these feelings. You're not even this body. You're golden. I remember hearing, you're golden. Your soul is whole. There's nothing wrong. And it gave me this like deep feeling of gratitude while I was in the most pain of my life. I would say it was an experience of bliss, recognizing once again, back to that original story, that I'm alive. And even if all I have is 5 minutes, I'm here in gratitude. And so, yeah, I had waves of rage and anger and abandonment and rejection from being left there. However, throughout the night, it just continued to compound. So I don't even know if I shared this, because that night, everything changed for me. I had experienced a lot of trauma physically, mentally, emotionally, socially at that point in my life that caused a lot of spiritual turmoil as well. And my wife, God bless her heart, she's truly a living angel. I refused to go to the hospital still when I got home. I hate hospitals. I just despise them. I hate the fluorescent light bulbs and sitting in an impersonal room by yourself. I just didn't want to go through it. Because have you ever had road rash and had to go to the hospital?
Mm-mm.
They use something that's kind of like a wire brush. No matter how many shots of, you know, pain numbing agent. Yep. No matter how many, a wire brush touching those nerve endings is truly the most excruciating pain I've ever experienced. And I didn't think I had the capacity to go through that. I knew that we had stopped the bleeding enough. I had experienced enough road rash before to know I'd be okay. I knew things were out of socket and I might have some breaks and some cracks, but I said, I'll go in the morning, right? My wife sat there for literally 3.5-4 hours picking pavement and chunks out of what looked like burger from my toe all the way to my crotch, right? And I don't know how she did it. She's like a surgeon. And finally, she had me all gauzed up, Vaselined up, tightened up. And I just wanted to lay in bed. And I remember I had this crystal, I'm kind of a crystal junkie.
Of course you are.
Right. So I had this crystal that's really important to me. And I was holding it over my heart and I was laying in bed. It was like 4:30, 4:45 in the morning. I'd been laying there for probably 20, 30 minutes, just praying and really just connecting, communing with my creator. And also feeling waves of sadness and rage and anger and all the things anyone would feel in their humanness in that moment. And my wife's voice came out of nowhere. And she said, hey, babe, I know you're hurting right now. And I don't just mean physically. She said, if I were you, and I went through what you went through tonight, I could totally justify giving up on all of humanity. Like, I could justify that. I could see how you could just give up on people. However, I just want to remind you that whoever those kids were that left you there, whether they even went and got blind drunk tonight to forget about it, they'll never forget about it. Their whole life, this will haunt them. There was 3 other people in that vehicle that weren't driving. One of them wanted to get out and help you. And they'll grow up and this will haunt them when they have children. Every motorcycle they see, they will remember that and it will fill them with shame. They will feel a sense of guilt. And they may never forgive themselves. It was right then that I recognized inside myself that redemption is only ours. And that I had, until that moment, carried so much guilt and shame from my moments of sin and my moments of reactionary response from following the desires of my flesh and the impulses and reactions of chaos, that I had been carrying so much shame and guilt that nobody could release me from except myself. And her intention wasn't to release me from all the pain and the trauma and the self-beat up I'd held against myself. It was really for me to release them. And her next thing she said is, can you? All I wanted to do is go find those kids and hug them and tell them I'm golden. I'm going to heal. I'm going to heal fast. I'm not going to take my life and my light for granted. This is a gift to me. Even if I lose my leg, I'm grateful that I'm here and I have life. I forgive you. But I remember laying there, and I don't remember falling asleep, but I do remember the feeling of release and redemption that I'd never felt before. And I felt the prison I'd held myself in until that moment, when I recognized that all of us and only us can, before our Creator, forgive ourselves and ask to be absolved of our sin, of our regret, of our shame, of our guilt. And that was special. So I'm grateful for that trauma. I probably missed some pieces, and I shared probably more than I thought I would. But it was life-changing for me. And last thing I'll say, it was that night right then, right before I dozed off, I made a decision that I wouldn't make my life an actionable response or a logical decision, that I would choose with my heart and my soul and everything that I did. You know, it's when you are in those near-death experiences, you recognize the moments you've chose comfort over courage. And I was like, I'm never going to choose comfort over courage ever again. The day I got my cast off, all my leg stuff, it wasn't a cast, it was a soft cast, I adopted my grandparents. I moved them in with me. And I moved out of the town I was in. And I completely changed everything about my life. And it absolutely shaped a new reality for me. So I know that was probably a run-on sentence, and I appreciate you creating the container and space for me to share that, because it wasn't just life-changing, it was life-defining. And I want to give one more piece to it, if you don't mind. So it was months later. I mean, I didn't heal right away. I was a gimp for quite a while. Although I'm resilient and I have fortitude, and they tell you don't walk, I was walking day four. I had a baby 8 days later, and I already had an 18-month-old. So as you can imagine, it was a little challenging, but I'm also a little bit stubborn in the most beneficial way. But it was months had gone by, and my wife, it was Father's Day, and she's like, what do you want to do for Father's Day? And we lived in Montana still. I was like, oh, I want to go to the Montana Vortex. I'm obsessed with geomagnetic energy. If you go to USGS, magnetic anomalies, and you study where the little anomalies are and you go there, even if you don't know what you're experiencing, you will experience something. It's like Sedona. There's areas where you're like, wow, there's something tangible here. So we went to this place, and they've kind of turned it into like a gimmick, like fun house. It's kind of like cheesy, right? Optical illusions and different things. But the whole property has different zones that have been scientifically mapped. One of them, you can see your aura in your shadow. You can see your aura in the shadow. I remember holding my baby boy and seeing the aura of a child versus mine, just emanating and transmitting this radiant light. I still have it on video. Sometime I'll pull it up and show you. But then there's a labyrinth built around, there's this masculine vortex. That's where energy is coming down to the earth. Think of the North Pole. It's a North Pole. It's coming down into the earth. And then there's a feminine vortex. That's where electric magnetic energy is leaving the earth. Where those two vortices have these big energy fields and they merge. Between them, they create a separate, I don't even know what to call it. It's a masculine-feminine convergence of energy. And they've built this labyrinth path, like a traditional Tibetan or Native American labyrinth, right where this sits. And if you've ever walked a labyrinth, the intent matters more than anything. I take my shoes off, take all my technology, I go as bare naked as I possibly can. I set an intention. Higher self, God, creator, divine, whatever that is for you, I am open to receive the signs, the symbols, and the messages with the intention of healing all of my physical, mental, emotional, and social pain from this life and lives past, but I'm very specific. And I also want to be able to have such a clear answer that I can provide that and offer that to anybody. I'll never forget this. I've never shared this on video. I walk the labyrinth. I stop in the center. There's this giant piece of rose quartz in the middle. And you can feel it. It's tangible. It's pulsing with energy. And I set that same intention. Creator, great I am, King of heaven on earth, I'm open to receive the signs, symbols, and messages and download whatever is required to release all the pain of my past lives, and anything that may come in the future, and be able to provide that as a solution to others. I felt it, Tyler, so deep. I felt the warmth and the radiation of that light and that energy and the answer before it hit my intellect. I felt what I would call unconditional love, infinite love. You hear me say infinite love all the time too. And I'm very left brain though. I could ask God for a sign and God punches me in the mouth. I'm like, the reticular activating system is a powerful machine of the mind. I need another one just to validate. And I'll see a sign on the road. I'll be like, now I'm looking for him. Can you give me one more? Right? Like, that's me. So I felt it. I knew what it was. And then I opened my eyes, and not to the left, not to the right, not up, not down, on a tree, right where I opened my eyes, there was a little sign. And it said, the pain you're feeling is the love you're withholding. The human mind, the human body can only think one thing and feel one thing at a time. And that was so profound for me. And that was like kind of like that chapter for me, not only closing, but the rest of the book, the rest of my life, my journey, opening. Because it allowed me to recognize that no matter what, and I feel pain in my body every day. Those are a couple of the accidents. I'm pieced together. And the pain you feel is the love you withhold. And it's proven in psychology. Anytime you're thinking about yourself, you're injecting hormones that cause disharmony and melancholy and even potentially depression. And when we're thinking about in service to others, when we're thinking about contribution to others, hormones are being injected that cause us to feel bliss and love, even in the face of warfare and challenge and resistance and difficulty. The pain you feel is the love you withhold. I harvested that from that experience. Thank you for the space to share that.
You're welcome. Thank you for doing it. I want to end with this, okay? And then clearly we will do this again, maybe many times. But I want to end with this. You've obviously been through a lot. You've had you've been broken physically, spiritually, mentally. I know even more about your story than what you've shared today. There's a lot of men that are dealing with their own version of being broken physically, mentally, spiritually. What advice would you share with men who feel broken and broken beyond the ability to be fixed?
Yeah, I think that's the big one. Find the statistic. If you're in that statistic, find it. Find out how many other people are experiencing that. Because it's easy when you isolate yourself to be in that pain to just be in that pain. But the moment you recognize other people are suffering at the same capacity as you, I believe that immediately alleviates some of it. Because I believe that the biggest problem when we're hurting is the loneliness of that pain. And to me, empathy is just recognizing the pain of others. That's all empathy is. I recognize your suffering. I recognize your pain. And so if you're in pain and you're suffering and you're struggling, if you just acknowledge the statistic and recognize that other people are hurting as well, it immediately opens up and activates that moral fiber embedded in every single human. And it starts to open your eyes to not just want to heal for yourself, but to help them heal. I don't believe any one of us is on this earth on accident. Ask yourself, with all the variables, all the chances that you're even here, being almost impossible, how could you say you're here on accident? Are you here on accident, Tyler?
No.
So what's the opposite of on accident?
Purpose.
On purpose. So recognize if you're going through some pain, look, for most of human culture, we found our strength in our pain tolerance, right? You think of Roman culture. Yeah, Stoicism. The person who can experience pain and not complain is the strongest in the tribe. However, we're at a place now where if you just pause for a second and you recognize there's other people hurting, even if you progress a millimeter, you can provide that to millions of people. And that might not seem like a big deal if you can just improve a little. But I believe that it starts to cycle and snowball very quickly. And service and compassion begins to lead your motive to heal. Back to the other side of it, like the pain you feel is the love you withhold. And so if you're sitting in that pain, you're being selfish. And there are people here on this earth that are suffering that might not have the perspective awareness to even look for a solution. And, you know, it really comes down to this. I could answer this for 45 minutes. But I remember, I don't know why I'm thinking of this right now. I remember after, you know, 9/11, we went to Iraq. And I'll never forget this picture. It was a picture of a man that had ran over an IUD, blew off almost a whole arm, blew off almost a whole hand, blew off both of his legs beneath the knee. And he's triaged on the battlefield, wrapped up, about to get on the medvac. And he asked if they'd take a picture of him. And he took a picture, smiling with thumbs up. And that impacted me so much. Because back to free will, is there anything on the planet that can prevent you from smiling? Is there anything on the planet that can prevent you from finding presence of what doesn't hurt? If you get stung by a bee on your left foot, it hurts. Ask yourself, how's my right foot feel? Can I smell the breeze and the trees and the wind? And we can shift our awareness at will. And that serves other people to not worry about us, have pity for us, sympathy for us, and set an example for others that they can do the same. So I think the biggest thing for people going through hard times is recognize you're not alone. There are other people hurting as well. And the last thing I'll share, you know, back to tribal strength, you know, it's the reason we say fuck instead of owie when we step on a Lego. Because for most of human culture, emotions were seen as weakness. I would say when you go to the gym and you want to grow a bicep, what do? You pick up the heaviest shit possible and you lift it until it's as painful as it can be. Recognize if there's pain in your life that maybe you signed a contract with your creator to be one of the strongest motherfuckers that ever lived. Smooth seas don't make skillful sailors. Ask yourself, if I chose to develop spiritual muscle, we all know that there's going to be some pain if you want to grow muscle. What strength was I choosing? Because that's what that pain is for. It's for you to learn. It's for you to grow. It's for you to accept your birthright of strength from your creator. That's what I would share.
Amen. Jeremy, thank you for coming on the roller coaster today, man. It was a pleasure. That's a wrap.